over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Today, the Roundtable continues its series of important programs on problems of Asia. To open today's discussion on Indonesia, we present Philip Talbot, political scientist of the University of Chicago, who has recently returned from 4 months in Southeast Asia, and who is now serving as senior associate of the Institute of Current World Affairs. And now, Mr. Talbot.
This last week, the Republic of Indonesia became the 60th member nation of the United Nations. In a cordial ceremony, the nations of the world then welcomed another of the states of Southern Asia, which have risen from colonial status to political independence since the last war. Indonesia has been described as a necklace of thousands of tropical islands lying off the southeastern fringe of Asia. Of its more than 75 million people, 50 million live on the main island of Java, which is about as large as New York State. Indonesia is now legally a free and self-governing member of the Netherlands-Indonesian Union. The United States has a special interest in this new country. We use substantial quantities of its outpourings of rubber, tin, spices, and coconut oil, and its petroleum helps move world commerce. Americans have watched the flowering of the political aims of the Indonesians, and on occasion helped in the long negotiations between the Dutch and the Indonesians, which led last year to independence. The American Export-Import Bank has granted a credit of $100 million to help Indonesia revive its war-torn economic life, and the Economic Cooperation Administration is undertaking an economic and technical aid program for the country. New nations are not born without travail, as Indonesians now know well. Among those joining me today in this discussion of Indonesia as a new state and of its prospective role in the world is John Embry, social anthropologist of Yale University. Embry, what is significant to you in the Indonesian picture?
It is refreshing and also important to know that in Indonesia, the United States is extending the hand of friendship to a government made up of real national leaders and with real popular support. This is a happy contrast to our usual policy in Southeast Asia, where we have attempted to back up governments which have very little real support among the people.
Taking part also in today's roundtable is Charles Wolfe, Jr., former American Vice Consul in Indonesia and author of The Indonesian Story, who is now an economist in the Far Eastern Program of the Economic Cooperation Administration. Wolf, you are familiar with Indonesian development. What strikes you as most important?
The thing that strikes the economic eye in looking at Indonesia, I think, is the great possibilities for economic development and growth which the country enjoys. Indonesia has great untapped mineral resources, petroleum, tin, bauxite, great agricultural resources in potential development in Sumatra and Borneo, and above all, great human resources.
We are privileged to have with us today also Indonesia's first ambassador to the United States, His Excellency Dr. Ali Sastro Amijoyo. Mr. Ambassador, you come as a man who has participated in the Indonesian's long revolutionary struggle. A revolutionary struggle also preceded the foundation of this country and was based on the same yearning for political freedom. But I know that the Indonesian leaders have had particular goals in the creation of your country. Would you be good enough to state some of these?
Like every nation in the world, the Republic of Indonesia is based on a political philosophy. The American political philosophy on which the American nation bases its way of life is contained in the Declaration of Independence. In the same way, Indonesian political philosophy, which is called the Pancasila or Five Principles, is contained in the Indonesian Constitution. These five principles are: 1, belief in the divine omnipotence; 2, nationalism; 3, humanity; 4, democracy; and 5, social justice. These five principles oppose the principles of colonialism during the 45 years when the Indonesian people were fighting for their national independence. Our people based their struggle for independence on these principles because colonialism denied them responsibility and destroyed their initiative so that their lives became hollow and senseless. Economic degradation and general demoralization are the elements of a vicious circle in which the colonial people were caught. Nationalism in colonial countries is born out of despair, not only because of poverty, but because of the impossibility to lead a life with purpose and in dignity. Nationalism is an ethical movement against a life of subjugation, which means a senseless life and one of bondage. At the same time, it is a fight for regaining that factor which gives purpose to one's life. Therefore, the Indonesian nationalist movement was primarily based on an ethical foundation. Colonialism had first to end for the regaining of human dignity and the betterment of living conditions. But our present national state is not, in our opinion, the end of our struggle, because we believe that the evils of humiliation of human dignity cannot be destroyed simply by the achievement of national independence. We needed political freedom for the realization of the ultimate aims of democracy, social justice, and prosperity for the people. This is the very gist and motivation of the Indonesian Revolution. It should be noted that this Indonesian National Revolution brought about the so-called Indonesian Question, which ended by peaceful negotiation in the Hague Round Table Conference with the assistance of the United Nations. It is therefore significant to state that Indonesia's world policy is based on the principles of its National Revolution and those of the United Nations. This fortunate combination contains the elements of the preservation of national independence without carrying with it a retreat to isolation in an exclusive ivory tower, because the Indonesian people believe in international cooperation between free and independent nations. This preservation of national independence, not only for Indonesia, but for all the nations of the world, is dominant in Indonesia's stand on world affairs. It is true that in the world today, national sovereignty is more or less overruled by supranational entities. But we believe that international cooperation and supranational authority can only be achieved on the basis of freedom and independence of all nations in the world. This is particularly important to us in Southeast Asia, where colonialism has not yet completely disappeared. One effect is that Indonesia is still one of the underdeveloped countries. Our republic is at present confronted with the problem of improving educational, health, and social conditions of the more than 75 million people. Although these problems must be solved in the first place by our national government and the Indonesian people themselves, we also look for international cooperation in this field.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Those are high aims and broad objectives. And I think those of us at this table who have all been in Indonesia recognize that they stimulated the Indonesian people in their drive for independence. But I'm sure that you would be among the first to agree that in order to achieve such goals, many jobs remain to be done and many difficulties remain in the way. For example, when I was in Indonesia last spring, it struck me that one of the problems facing the government then was the difficulty of consolidating the very many people from the different types of administration which were trying to run the country, so that really it seemed there were two or three people for each necessary job, and the government had a problem of what to do with those who were surplus.
I think you are referring to the time when we were still in an administrative setup of a so-called federal organization.
Yes, that's right.
Therefore, because of our shortage of technical personnel, we had to distribute our people within Indonesia, which is very large, as you know. But now we have converted the federal state of Indonesia into one single unified state, with the advantage to concentrate all the available administrative personnel in one place.
seems to me that closely related to the problem of shortage of administrative and technical personnel are the vast economic problems that Indonesia faces. I think in looking at the economic picture in Indonesia, you're struck by an interplay of factors of strength and factors of weakness. On the side of strength, you find that Indonesia's aggregate production is nearing and in some cases exceeding pre-war levels.
That's true, is it, in the main fields of economic enterprise?
Yes, particularly in case of Indonesia's major exports. Rubber is now at an annual rate of 25% above pre-war levels. Tin is over 50% above pre-war levels. And copra and petroleum, while still below pre-war levels, are moving up to those levels.
Is it fair to say, then, that Indonesia has again become a very prosperous country?
I think it's fair to say that, but we must keep fully in mind the other side of the picture, the vast problems and the vast difficulties that are faced by Indonesia. To some extent, these increases in production and the very favorable export prices that Indonesia currently enjoys can furnish leverage for meeting these vast problems, but the problems are vast. For example, due to a population increase since the war of 10 to 15%, Indonesia is faced by a situation with considerably lower living standards than before the war, with a price inflation of 10 to 12 times before pre-war levels. We find that real wages in Indonesia are considerably below pre-war.
Well, now, what does that mean in terms of the ordinary Indonesian at all?
It means that the working Indonesian and the agricultural peasant enjoys a lower level of consumption than he did before the war, roughly 10 to 15% below what he enjoyed then.
Mr. Ambassador, would you agree to that?
Yes, I do. And this is just the very gist of our problem in Indonesia. I mean, the economic problem for the raising of the standard of living of the people is very important and very crucial in Indonesia. I think Mr. Wolf made a very good point on
it. It seems to me that in doing this, in attaining this objective of raising the standard of living, Indonesia has to deal with a vast transport and communications problem involving all of its 730,000 square miles, has a great problem of improving agricultural techniques, introducing fertilizer and improving irrigation facilities, has a great problem of resettling population from Java, where the annual increase in excess population is over a million, moving these people to areas in Sumatra and Borneo which can take them.
In regard to this matter of transferring people to solve population, I'm always a little skeptical of that as a long-range solution.
I think it is a temporary expedient, but we have to meet first things first. Would you agree with that, Mr.
I'd agree with you, Mr. Wolf.
Would you say then, Mr. Ambassador, that repairing the roads, for example, so that the products of the estates can get to the ports is one of your first jobs?
Yes, but generally speaking, the improvement of road building and other means of transportation is important in the general economic problem of Indonesia. And we are fortunate to have this $100 million loan from the Export-Import Bank of America. And we will use this for the implementation of our project in this matter.
I'd like to throw in one question. It seemed to me in Indonesia that one of the difficulties was that with all the great economic development plans, there were very few actual Indonesians who were trained to do the sort of work that would be necessary if Indonesians were to take over the jobs which had previously been held by Dutch or by Chinese or by other people.
That is true. But it is only logical if viewed from the angle of colonialism. We were deprived to have trained so many technical personnel as you were referring to. But we are trying to get technical assistance from the international world.
I think the problem you're suggesting is the problem of training and acquiring technical and administrative personnel. I think it's in precisely these terms that American aid, particularly the EPA's program in Indonesia, should be construed. Not simply adding resources to Indonesia's economy to meet these great problems of economic development and reconstruction, but of enabling, furnishing technical and administrative assistance and training facilities in order to enable Indonesia to make most effective use of the resources it has.
How about the question of the organization of labor unions and labor groups in Indonesia and what we hear of reported communist penetration of those labor unions?
I think there is a great growth in labor organization in Indonesia since the war, and there have been recent strikes which have, I think, been directly related to the fall in real wages in the consumption level of the laboring population. Dr. Ali, what?
There are a couple of other problems which I think you always have to consider when you discuss these economic measures.
Yes, Emory, go ahead.
One of these, of course, is education. Indonesia has a very serious problem with illiteracy. The vast majority of the people cannot yet read and write. There is a real problem here in mass education in the national language of Indonesian. That involves not only a bigger school system, but it involves a special problem of teaching people of different kinds of linguistic backgrounds.
I wonder whether the ambassador would agree that literacy is necessary before any sort of real advance can come to a country.